Okay. So we can move on to the next sutta. This is called, this name of the sutta is Delicate, from the Anguttara Nikaya 3:39. And we are continuing with different types of meditation, different types of reflection. And the idea, again, is how to overcome the defilements of the mind. This is really the purpose of these kind of reflections. And this next sutta is one of the main themes here, is the idea of death, recollecting of death. How does that help us on the path? How does that help us to overcome the defilements? That's basically what this is about. So let's have a look at what the Buddha has to say. And this is another sutta where the Buddha talks about his life before he ordained, right before he became a monk, and how he was thinking, and basically saying, well, this, you know, this is how you should practice too. Okay, bhikkhus, I was delicately nurtured, most delicately nurtured, extremely delicately nurtured. At my father's residence, lotus ponds were made just for my enjoyment. In one of them, blue lotuses bloomed. In another one, red lotuses, and in a third, white lotuses. I used no sandalwood unless it came from Kasi, and my headdress, jacket, lower garment, and upper garment were made of cloth from Kasi. By day and by night, a white canopy was held over me so that cold and heat, dust, grass, and dew would not settle on me. I had three mansions, one for the winter, one for the summer, and one for the rainy season. I spent the 4 months of the rains in the rainy season mansion, being entertained by musicians, none of whom were male, and I did not leave the mansion. While in other people's homes, slaves, workers, and servants are given broken rice together with sour gruel for their meals, in my father's residence they were given choice hill rice, meat, and boiled rice. So this is the Buddha talking about how he grew up. And of course, one of the things that you see here is that it's quite, the way he explains it is quite different from how you would often hear about the Buddha's growing up. In the later the texts, the later they are, the more kind of fantastic and amazing it was. And he grew up in this enormous palace and all those kind of things. But here it is relatively, it's obviously luxurious for the day, but there's nothing too extreme here, right? It's kind of within limits, within reasonable limits. And this is what you find. The further back in time you go, the more you go back to the original suttas, the more reasonable they tend to be, the more kind of down-to-earth it all is. And that somehow that gives a certain sense of credibility here. So, anyway, he obviously had some luxuries. And one of the luxuries that you will see here is the sandalwood and also the clothes that came from made of Kasi cloth. Kasi is another word, a name for Benares, Varanasi in the north of India, for those of you who have been there. And apparently still today in India it's known as both Kasi and Varanasi. Both of those words are still used today. And it's interesting, here you have the Kasi cloth, right? So if you go to India today and you go to Benares, they still sell you cloth in Benares, because the Kasi and Benares cloth is supposed to be very good, even to the present day. So it makes the suttas become very real, right? When it's this kind of the situation is still the same after 2,500 years. You think, wow, there's something to this. It's not just, it makes it real in a sense, which is quite nice. The rest of this is just about the different types of luxuries that he was able to indulge in those days. And one of the nice things here, I feel, about what he considers here a good home, right, or a good household, is that the servants and the workers and the slaves, they will look after too, right? It's not just a matter of luxury, but a good household is one where there is a sense of kindness and compassion. It's a nice little touch there as to what is considered a good household. It's not just about what you consume and what you use, but actually is about kind of the atmosphere in the house, right? How do you treat each other? If you treat each other well, that is a good householder. So it's quite nice. Anyway, now we come to the real content of this sutta. And the Buddha says that amid such splendor and a delicate life, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to old age, not exempt from old age, feels repelled, humiliated and disgusted when he sees another who is old, overlooking his own situation. Now I too am subject to old age and not exempt from old age. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated and disgusted when seeing another who is older, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with youth was completely abandoned. So it starts off by saying, amid such splendor, right? In other words, he was living this life of great luxury, and that's when he had this thought, right? So this thought is, again, the idea is that the danger of the luxury and the splendor is that you tend to be intoxicated by it. You get so attached to it, you forget about the realities of life. But here he's saying that regardless of that, it occurred to me this, in the middle of all those intoxicating things, I had this thought. An uninstructed worldling, this is a person who hasn't heard any Dhamma. A worldling is the putujana, literally the many person, putu many jana person. So it's like the many person, the ordinary person. Uninstructed means asutava. And asutava means somebody who has not heard the teachings, right? Sutta is hearing, and that's how instruction happened in those days. They didn't have any books. You couldn't just open up the Majjhima Nikaya and Gutra and read things out. Instruction happened orally. You were transferred orally. So someone who is not learned or instructed is someone who hasn't heard. So this is the uninstructed person. And what happens to such a person? They often feel repelled and humiliated and disgusted when you see somebody who is older. How do you feel if you see somebody who's old? I mean, say really old, right? Like so old that you're kind of, you can't really look after yourself anymore. You know, old person's home, right? You're not, body doesn't function anymore. Kind of things are leaking everywhere, right? That sort of thing. How does that feel? Do you feel a bit kind of, does it feel a bit sort of unpleasant, or are you perfectly okay with that? And many people feel a bit sort of, the kind of lack of, you know, it feels a bit unpleasant to be around that, because you recognize that it is a state where you don't really want to be, which doesn't feel good, right? You are completely dependent on others for looking after yourself for everything in life. It is not just not nice. So how do you feel? So this is an important question. And if you feel humiliated, then as the Buddha says here, you are you're kind of overlooking that this is your situation too, right? You're going to be there one day. Now, when you are getting humiliated, it's almost like you're getting humiliated by yourself. This is you. We're all going to be there. So how can you get humiliated? That's like having aversion to oneself, in a sense. And this is such a useful reflection, the idea that old age is already in us. It's already part of us. Old age and youth are opposite sides of the same coin. One cannot exist with the other one. So if you are not old yet, or even if you are very young, it's in you, it's part of you, part of who you are. And once you understand that that's part of you, you won't get humiliated anymore when you see these things, because otherwise you're just getting humiliated by yourself, in a sense. So it's very, this is what the Buddha is saying here. And when you understand that you are already old in many ways. If you're old, you are still young. Because these things are absolutely inseparable from each other. When you see that, then that intoxication with youth is abandoned, right? This idea that we are intoxicated by these things. The idea that if you feel that you are young, yeah, I'm young, and you're kind of repelled by old age. And it's like being drunk, right? There's a drunkenness there, a lack of being in touch with reality. And when people are drunk, what they do all kind of crazy things, because they lose the sense of what is right and what is wrong. And it's exactly the same thing. If you are drunk with youth, you do crazy things, and that is a problem with being younger, and not necessarily being young, but with forgetting about the reality of these things. So you pull back, and you remember, old age is already part of me. And that kind of sobers you up, right? Well, wait a minute, it sobers you up. It's already part of me. And then when it sobers you up, that's when you stop doing crazy things as a consequence. So this is the idea behind this. This is how these kind of contemplations work. So remember that. All that is already there. We talked about this yesterday as well a little bit about, overcoming desire for the opposite gender, and that sort of thing. You know, you're going to be old. The other person is going to be older. What you're getting attracted to is not just a young person or a middle-aged person. What you're getting attracted to, this old age, is already there. You're also getting attracted to old age at the same time. You don't see it, but that's actually the reality behind the surface. So it takes away the delusion. It takes away the intoxication. Brings the reality home. Okay. Next one. Again, it occurred to me. An uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to illness, not exempt from illness, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who is ill, overlooking his own situation. Now, I too am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who is ill, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with health was completely abandoned. Okay, so here, illness, right? Illness is the same thing. How do you feel when you see somebody who is ill? Again, really, really ill. Sometimes when people get very ill, they look terrible. You know, they are emaciated and thin and wretched and full of suffering and pain. And again, they can't look after themselves. You may have seen some of these new packaging on the cigarette packages here in Australia. I don't know if you've seen those. And some of those pictures are terrible. They are like cancer patients who got lung cancer, and they are emaciated, and they look absolutely terrible. There was one packet I saw. This is not because I smoke myself, but it's because you see these things lying around. People just chuck them out. So, and one picture had this before and after picture, kind of this handsome man, right, looking very good looking. And then a few years later, you had exactly the same person looking absolutely, completely wretched and terrible, because he was emaciated and obviously dying of lung cancer. Quite astonishing, the difference there. And of course, we're all subject to these things, right? We can all get cancer. We can all get heart disease. We can all get AIDS or whatever it is. All of these things can happen. You just don't know what's going to happen. So it is part of us. It is part of who we are. When you have this kind of body, which is subject to all the conditions of the world, the reality of this kind of body is that it gets sick every now and again. It's unavoidable. It's like Adam Brahms saying when he says, "Doctor, doctor, something is right with me. I'm sick again today," right? It's a nice way of looking at it, because actually there's nothing wrong with being sick. It is part of nature. You have to expect illness in life. And when you do that, you have more also, when you understand that this is your nature, you don't feel again this sense of being repelled and humiliated when you see somebody else. And when you don't have that, you have more ability to be able to help out and to be compassionate and kind. And then the intoxication of health is abandoned. You don't go around feeling healthy, getting intoxicated by it, and just thinking, "Yeah, I'm healthy. I can do whatever I want." No, you remember that there's a time limit there. It's only going to last so long, and then things will start to go wrong again. So those are two contemplations, and both of these contemplations you find in a few places in the suttas, and they are said to be the sort of contemplations that you do both as a monastic and also as a layperson. These are very universal types of contemplation. But the next contemplation, and this is the one which I really like, and the one which is by far the most powerful of those three, and this is the contemplation on death. And this death contemplation is something that you see throughout the sutta, something that Buddha talks about again and again in so many different cases, places and cases. And the reason obviously must be that it is very important, it's very powerful. It has a sense to move us very powerfully in the right direction. So death contemplation is very important in the suttas. So I would recommend all of you, if you feel very uncomfortable with it, then, you know, be careful, obviously. But if you feel comfortable, if you're okay with this, this is very highly recommended by the Buddha himself. Check out, try out the death contemplation. So the way it is described here is very much in the same way as the previous ones. Let's have a look at what happens here. So an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to death, not exempt from death, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who has died, overlooking his own situation. Now I too am subject to death, and I'm not exempt from death. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who has died, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with life was completely abandoned. This is kind of one of the basic things about humanity, about being human, right? Or being any kind of being. You're going to die. What do they say? The only two certainties in life are death and taxes. Taxes is far less certain than death. You know, death is really absolutely certain. So it is such an absolute certainty, and yet it is something that we often don't really, it's not really on our mind, right, in our daily life. It's something we forget, and because we forget it again, we tend to do all kinds of things we otherwise wouldn't be doing. So the point of doing the death contemplation, there's many different points, but the main point is just to get a sense of clarity, get a sense of priority, get a sense of perspective. What really matters in life? What is actually important, right? If you're going to die, if you're going to give up this whole world, which is right here around us, what are you going to do? How are you going to live your life if everything has to be given up anyway? You don't know when it's going to be. It could be very soon, right? This is one of the things about death. Not only is it certain, but it's also the uncertainty of when. And one of the things that you see as a monk, you see all kinds of people dying, all kinds of ages, from the tiniest babies all the way to the very old, and the whole spectrum in between. And sometimes we think that it's not going to be me, right? I'm going to live till I'm 80. It's only other people who die when they are kind of, you know, 40 or 30 or 20, but not me. I'm not one of those. We tend to kind of make it external. It's got nothing to do with us. And that's just delusion, right? That's not being realistic. It could be us. We just don't know when we're going to die. And because of that uncertainty, you have to be ready now. Now is the only time you can be ready. You can't wait till you're going to die to be ready, because you don't know when it's going to be. So now is the time to be ready. Now is the only opportunity you have to be ready for death. So that's why you have to kind of internalize it now. Okay, what if I'm going to die in 2 hours? What does that feel like? What does that feel like if you're going to die in 2 hours' time? Or even shorter, or in a day's time, or whatever it is. What does it feel like? And what you find is that when you start to reflect like that, when you really, really bring it home that you actually could die in 2 hours, it's not a fantasy, it actually is the case that could happen. One day it is going to happen. So now is the time to feel what it's like. What happens? If you're going to die in 2 hours, are you going to be angry and upset with the people around you? Anger and upset always comes because we have some kind of problem with the people around us, right? They have done something against us, and we want to kind of try to sort it out by being angry, by telling them off or whatever. But if you're going to leave this world and you will never ever see this person again, and there's nothing you can do to solve the problem, are you going to be angry? Are you going to lie on a deathbed and your last things you think is all these angry words? Imagine that you are, you know, you're lying on your deathbed and you're very, very close to death. And then people come into the room and they kind of want to argue with you. Are you going to argue back? you're not going to argue back, right? Because you're about to die. You're out of this world. You're not interested in the worldly things of this world anymore. You just let it go. Okay, you go and argue, whatever, I don't care. Do whatever you like. I don't want to have a part of that. Once you have this perception of death inside, make it clear and strong, all of these things like ill will, etc., tend to go out of the window. Because it has to do with this world. Everything has to do with this world. And you're leaving this world. Why are you going to hold on to the stuff of this world? You won't, right? Or desires. Almost all the desires we have are related to this world. What we're going to have, our next relationship, our new such and such, our next meal, or whatever it is, almost everything, all the desires we have relate to this world. But if you are dying, and you're not ever going to see anything in this world anymore, you're not going to sit on a deathbed planning your next house, right? That doesn't make any sense. Or you're not going to sit there planning anything, your next relationship or whatever it is. All of that just becomes completely irrelevant because it all relates to this world. It doesn't relate to your future life. And as I said to some people, I can't remember where I said this, but it's a nice little story. When I was with my father back in Norway about almost a year ago now, I think it was, he told me, he said, you know, he said to me, you know, I've been quite successful in life. I've had a good job. I made you know enough money. Everything he did, he was quite good at things, and he did well in life, and he had everything he wanted and everything people can ever have, a good career and all these kind of things. And then he said to me that, you know, now he's getting old, right, in his mid-70s or whatever. And he says, you know, I wonder why. What was the purpose of all that? What was the point? I'm going to die. All of that, everything I've done in life, I'm going to have to leave behind. All of those things that I did belong to this world. They don't belong to the future. You can't take this with me when I die. Everything belongs to this world. And it's like this. It sinks in that most of the things that we do in this life, we invest in this life, but we don't invest in what goes beyond this life. All our investment concerns what we're doing now, but not so much about the future. But in the face of death, when you look at death, how much are you willing to invest in this life when there's a much bigger picture to be looked after? So again, I thought it was very powerful. It kind of reminds you that there is a bigger picture there, right? Death reminded us a bigger picture here. It's not just about this life. In fact, this life is just a tiny little thing here. And it becomes relatively unimportant when you look at the big picture here. So, this is what it does. It takes away the craving. It takes away the ill will. And because of that, the mind becomes clear, right? Craving is about the future. Ill will is often about the past. We get involved in all these other things. You take that away, suddenly the mind comes into the present. And this is the purpose of the death contemplation. It's to get rid of all these defilements, get rid of all these problems that are always there. And it's driving the mind back into the present moment, back into the here and now. This is why we're doing this. So you can see here, it gets rid. When death contemplation is done in the right way, it gets rid of the defilements of the mind. Gets rid of the defilements, and then we are purifying ourselves. You sit down to meditate, and everything is much easier if it works, right? If it actually has the result that it's supposed to have. So how do you do this? And the first thing is just to know that it is a reality, right? You can die at any time. You could die in 2 hours' time. You could be bitten by a snake. You could just stumble and fall over in the staircase, right? These things happen all the time. People die at the most strangest of things. You have a heart attack, and suddenly you die. And things that are so unpredictable, what can happen next? So remember that. It's very unpredictable. It is a reality that you can die at any time. This is the first way of reflecting. The other way of reflecting is just to imagine yourself on your deathbed. This is going to happen. Don't imagine yourself as an old person. Imagine yourself as you are now, on your deathbed. And just know in your mind, I'm never going to be able to see anybody in this world ever again. None of my family, none of my friends, nobody else. I'm here by myself, right? Just me. There is nobody else to be able to help me in any way whatsoever. How do you feel when that happens? How do you feel when you're by yourself on your deathbed? Do you feel, no problems, you know, this is fine, I'm feeling peaceful and nice? Or do you feel, wait a minute, this is, you know, I'm not ready for this. I can't die yet. That's how most people feel, right? If you ask them, are you ready to die? They say, no, I'm getting there, but not yet, right? And we're always getting there. We're never really actually there, ready to die. Yeah? So see what happens when you do that contemplation. You're on your deathbed. Yeah? You know that you're never going to see anybody again in this whole world. Within a very short time, a few hours, you're going to be dead. What does it feel like? And when you do that feeling, then you start to see where the problems are in life. What are the things, the unfinished business? What are the stuff that you feel uncomfortable about? Is there anything with anybody that you would like to sort out before you die? Is there kind of, do you need to get your act together in a certain area? Is there a certain part of your character or virtue or that you haven't really purified enough yet, right? All of these questions will be answered once you are about to die. That is why I questioned the other day about this person who said that they were afraid of dying. Try to use that difficult situation in a positive way to see why, what is going on. And then you can use that difficult situation to grow instead of having that fear in your life. And then it becomes a wonderful opportunity rather than a threat to you. So these are the ways. And so try some of these things out and see what happens. And see what you can learn from that. And when the death contemplation works, it makes you peaceful. That is the power of the death contemplation. Sometimes when you see people who are dying well, people who understand, who have understood some of these things, and they're dying well, they become very peaceful because they're letting go of this world. Everything is being let go of. No more desires, no more ill will, just clarity in the mind, right? So instead of waiting until we die, let's bring that clarity in now, right away, because it is a powerful contemplation. Bring it into the meditation now, and then it becomes something very useful and powerful that we can use in our meditation practice. So that is all that is about death contemplation. So and then he says that then my intoxication with life was abandoned. You don't feel, yeah, I'm alive, I can run around, do whatever I like. And then you forget sometimes the consequences of all the things that you do because you are intoxicated in this way. It's interesting, right? Being intoxicated with life. It's a kind of interesting idea. You don't usually hear that very much. I'm intoxicated with being alive. So, anyway. Okay, so then we'll do the last part of the sutta here. And there are, bhikkhus, these three kinds of intoxication. What three? Intoxication with youth, intoxication with health, and intoxication with life. An uninstructed worldling intoxicated with youth engages in misconduct by body, speech and mind. With the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination in the lower world, even in hell. An uninstructed worldling intoxicated with health engages in misconduct by body, speech and mind. With the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination in the lower world, in hell. An uninstructed worldling intoxicated with life engages in misconduct by body, speech and mind. With the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination in the lower world, in hell. Intoxicated with youth, a bhikkhu gives up the training and reverts to the lower life. Intoxicated with health, he gives up the training and reverts to the lower life. Or intoxicated with life, he gives up the training and reverts to the lower life. So this is what happens when you're intoxicated, right? You don't see clearly, you lose your sense of perspective, you lose your sense of priorities, you forget about the long run and you only see the world as it is right now. And this is one reason why the idea of rebirth is so important, because it gives you the big picture about things and it changes your outlook quite dramatically. So don't be intoxicated in any way, neither with alcohol nor with anything else, and then you will have clarity of mind. And interesting here that it is These intoxications is what makes you give up the training or disrobe, right? Because you forget the limit of life. So you think, yeah, I'm going to disrobe and go out and enjoy myself. That's what you think. But and then you die, right? And you think, gee, I had this wonderful opportunity to do something powerful and very useful in the world. And I wasted it. I threw it out of the window. And I think that's what often happens. People, you know, you disrobe and you think back, gee, that was a big mistake. I was just intoxicated. And life is never what you think it is afterwards. So these are also like the safety mechanisms to stop you disrobing if you are a monastic. And interesting here, reverting to the lower life, right? The word lower here is hina. That's like in hina yana. This is hinaya. This is how lay life is often described by the Buddha in the suttas. It is called the lower life, lower in comparison to the monastic life. That's actually how it is described. It's quite interesting. And I think the reason why it is considered lower is simply because it takes longer. It's more difficult to have the same kind of progress in your practice as a monastic has. That's probably why it is considered lower, more crowded and more dusty, as we saw before. Okay, so that is for you the in particular, the most important thing here is the contemplation of death. And I would recommend you, everyone, to try it out, because this is a very important part of the spiritual life. And the contemplation of death is used everywhere, right? In all kinds of spiritual traditions that tend to bring this in. It's like almost like the one of the default things of a person who considers themselves spiritual, that they actually remember the limits of life. It's a very important part of this. So I got a couple of more suttas, which we have time for now, which is on the similar theme of recollection of death, but a bit more, just to kind of drive home the point a bit more, I suppose. The next one is the simile of the mountain, and this is one of the similes that I remember when I first started reading the suttas, made a great impact on me. I thought, wow, this is really, really powerful. So I thought it's nice to maybe perhaps read this one out. This is from the Sanghita Nikaya. The Buddha in conversation with King Pasenadi of Kosala. Well, this is happening at Savati, which was the capital of King Pasenadi. Then, in the middle of the day, King Pasenadi of Kosala approached the Blessed One. And the Blessed One said to him, as he was sitting to one side, "Now where are you coming from, great king, in the middle of the day?" The middle of the day is like, it's an unusual time to come, right? So there must be some special reason here. Not supposed to come at that time. "Just now, venerable sir, I have been engaged in those affairs of kingship, typical for head-anointed Khatiya kings, who are intoxicated with the intoxication of sovereignty, who are obsessed by greed for sensual pleasures, and who have attained stable control in the country, and who rule, having conquered a great sphere of territory on earth." So this is the king describing what it means to be a king, right? Head-anointed Khatiya king. These are the real kings of India in those days. The Khatiya or Kshatriyas, these are the caste of the aristocracy in India in those days. These were the people who were the kings and who were the military and the rulers of India in those days. And they are, it's interesting here how honest he is, right? He's basically saying about himself that, well, you know, I'm intoxicated with the intoxication of sovereignty, right? Power, right? Power, very intoxicating. Another of those intoxications that you have. And also intoxicated, obsessed by the greed for sensual pleasures. Sensual pleasures in itself is intoxicating. Whenever you have the desire for sensual pleasures, your mind is intoxicated. You can't see things clearly. And attain stable control in the country, and rule a large territory on earth. These were the kings of that day. And King Pasenadi was one of the greatest monarchs in India at the time of the Buddha. He ruled a very large country. How large? It How large would it have been? It would have been like maybe the size of a large European country or something like that. The size of Victoria, perhaps, in Australia. Not as large as Western Australia. That's just too large. but nonetheless, quite large for the day and for the time. And then the Buddha responds, what do you think, great king? Here a man would come to you from the east, one who is trustworthy and reliable. Having approached, he would tell you, for sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the east, and there I saw a mountain, a great mountain, high as the clouds, coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king. Then a second man would come to you from the west. Then a third man would come to you from the north. And a fourth man would come to you from the south, one who is trustworthy and reliable. Having approached, he would tell you, for sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the south, and there I saw a great mountain, high as the clouds, coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king. If, great king, such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of human life, the human state being so difficult to obtain, what should be done? Right? This is a powerful metaphor for the idea of death. Death is like completely inescapable, like a massive mountain walking in your direction and crushing everything underfoot, right? And there's no escape. It's coming from all directions at the same time. You can't get away. This is like the reality of death, right? It's moving now. It's moving towards you right now. Right now, this massive mountain is coming towards you. And it's even invisible. You can't see it. You don't know how far away it is. All you know is that it's moving in your direction at this very moment, right? That's what's going on. It's a powerful idea, isn't it? This invisible mountain ready to crush you at any time. So then King Pasenadi says, if, venerable sir, such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of human life, the human state being so difficult to obtain, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds? I inform you, great king, I announce to you, great king, old age and death are rolling in on you. When old age and death are rolling in on you, great king, what should be done? Because old age and death are rolling in on the venerable sir, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds? So it is, great king, so it is, great king. As old age and death are rolling in on you, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds? So that is the simile of the mountain, the invisible death and old age coming our way, crushing us from all directions. There's absolutely no escape. It has to happen at some point. Okay. So that is one of those suttas which you can maybe think about a bit. I really like that one. It really had an impact on me when I first read it. But one more sutta we can look at. This is also in the same vein about death, and this is known as the Araka Sutta. And I remember when I first read this one too, it made an impact on me. And it's still, now we are in the Anguttara Nikaya. So the Buddha says the following: Bhikkhus, in the past there was a teacher named Araka, the founder of a spiritual sect, one without desire or for sensual pleasures. The teacher Araka had many hundreds of disciples to whom he taught such a Dhamma as this. Brahmins, life is short. Life of human beings is short, limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. It's So this is obviously the Buddha is talking about some mythological or legendary teacher of the past, right? One who is free for desire or lust for sensual pleasures. In other words, somebody who has samadhi, right? Somebody who has given up the defilements that relate to this world, but is kind of intent on the world of the jhanas and the samadhi states. That's what that means. So in other words, somebody who is very worthy of respect, even though they haven't got the full insights that the Dhamma talks about. And he had many disciples, and he calls them Brahmins. The Brahmins in the suttas are just a word to describe somebody who is like spiritually worthy, right? You can call them venerable, or you call them Brahmins, or you call them Aryas, or all these kind of things. So Brahmins is just a way, an honorary way of talking to or about somebody. He's a real Brahmin. It's kind of, you know, good on you kind of thing. And then he has this teaching, right? Life is fleeting, etc. And then because you have an idea of this, you practice the spiritual life. You lose your intoxication, you practice the spiritual life. And then comes a few similes here of how fleeting life is. These are the similes taught by this teacher named Araka. Just as a drop of dew on the tip of a blade of grass will quickly vanish at sunrise and will not last long, so too, Brahmin, human life is like a drop of dew. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. Right? So that's what life is like. It's like a drop of dew on a blade of grass. When the sun rises, the drop of dew vanishes, right? And then your life is over. As soon as it has started, it's already gone. It's a bit like, sometimes it's good to ask people who are old, you know, very old, ask them about, you know, life, and ask them about what it feels like to be old. And most people who are old, not everybody, but most people would say, wow, it's gone so fast, right? It just has disappeared, like nothing. It's disappeared, just like the drop of dew on a blade of grass. Just as when thick drops of rain are pouring down and a water bubble will quickly vanish and will not last long, so too, Brahmin, human life is like a water bubble. Right? You see the water bubble on the in the puddles, etc. And goes like that, and it's disappeared. Just like a line drawn on water with a stick will quickly vanish and will not last long. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a line drawn on water with a stick. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Just as a river flowing down from a mountain, going a long distance with a swift current, carrying along much flotsam, will not stand still for a moment, an instant, a second, but will rush on, swirl and flow forward. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a mountain stream. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. That's it. That's a beautiful one. It's like this idea of a mountain stream, right? This stream which is coming down very fast. And this is what most people are like, right? They're running through life, rushing along, going here, going there, always thinking that they have something important to be done, right? This is what human life is like. And as Ajahn Brahm likes to say, you know, where are they hurrying to? Where are they going? Well, where they're going to either Karakatta or Fremantle. These are the two cemeteries in Perth. That's where they're going, right? This is where you're heading to. You're heading to your grave. You're rushing around. You think it's all so important. And suddenly one day you're in your grave and you think, what was all that about? What was I rushing for just to arrive here? And maybe that wasn't such a... And this is life, right? Life is a bit like that. You rush around. Everything seems so important right now. But when you're dying, it's kind of, you start to see the mirage. It was just a mirage. It wasn't really important at all. It was just life happening. And so that's a nice simile for life. This river flowing along. You're running around, driven by craving, a slave to craving, as it says in the suttas. Craving holds the whip, right? Making you rush around, do all kinds of things. Craving is in charge, and you're just a slave. That's a bit scary, isn't it? That's how it goes. Okay. Just as a strong man might form a lump of spittle on the tip of his tongue and spit it out without difficulty, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a lump of spittle. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Okay. So there you are. Human life is like a lump of spittle. That's pretty graphic for you, isn't it? Okay. It's a bit like what I was saying the other day. When you are reborn in the Devaloka, you don't want to come back to human life. It's like a cesspit in comparison. Just as a piece of meat thrown into an iron pan, heated all day, will quickly vanish, it will not last long. So true, Brahmins, human life is like a piece of meat. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. And just as when a cow to be slaughtered is being led to the slaughterhouse, whatever leg she lifts, she is close to slaughter, close to death. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a cow doomed to slaughter. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. Right? Every time that cow lifts a leg, she's one step closer to the slaughterhouse, right? Every time we do an action, every time we do anything, we are one step closer to death. We don't know when it's going to be. We're like a cow doomed to slaughter. Okay, some very, very nice similes there about death and how, yeah. Okay, and then comes, of course, the kind of the crux of the sutta, which was the thing that really kind of opened my eyes when I first read it. But at that time, because the human lifespan was 60,000 years, and the girls were marriageable at the age of 500. At that time, people had only six afflictions: cold, heat, hunger, thirst, excrement, and urine. Though people had such a long lifespan and lived so long, and the afflictions were so few, still the teacher Araka gave his disciples such a teaching. Brahmins, short is life, the life of human beings, etc., for none who are born can escape death. So there you are. So even if you're going to live for 60,000 years, still life is incredibly short, let alone if you live for... What do we live these as? 80 years perhaps? If you're lucky, you live for 8 years. If you're even more lucky, you live for 90. If you're not so lucky, you live for 50 or 40 or whatever. Whatever, bhikkhus, should be done by a compassionate teacher out of compassion for his disciples, seeking their welfare, that I have done for you. These are the feet of trees. These are empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not be heedless. Do not have cause to regret it later. This is our instruction to you. So that is the Buddha, having finished the simile, the story of Araka. This is what he says to his disciples. Don't regret it later on. Now is the opportunity. Now is the chance to meditate. You don't know. If you die without taking the opportunity, you are likely that you will regret it on your deathbed. And you don't want to die regretting things, right? When you die, you want to die with a light heart, a heart without regret, that is easy, that is relaxed, and you can move on into the future in a nice and peaceful way. That is the ideal thing. So these are the feet of the trees, the empty huts. Meditate. So, there you are. This is the few suttas on death contemplation. So again, try this out. And all of these things that we're looking at now, all of this is about how to overcome defilements, how to make your mind peaceful, how to ready yourself for meditation practice. All of this is about that. So this is things you can also do in daily life, right? I remember, I actually... coming to mind just now. There was when I was in Brisbane a few years ago, I met there was a man of Sri Lankan descent there. He was originally from Sri Lanka, and he was a psychologist. And he came to the monastery, and we talked about death contemplation. And he said to me, and I thought it was very nice what he said. He said that every day when I leave my house, when I say goodbye to my wife, when I say goodbye to my kids, I always make sure that I leave in a good way, because I always know I could die. I could die later on in the day. And if I were to die, then I would have regrets that I left the house in the wrong way, right? That's a nice way of using death contemplation in ordinary life, to make sure that you are don't get intoxicated by these things, and do things in the right way. Simple but powerful way of using a death contemplation. So try it out. Okay, so that is all for now. So we'll see you again later on this evening.
Mm-hmm.